I always think it's kind of elegant to start with poetry, so I'm going to start with two bits of poetry. The first is some verse written by communists in the early 1930s, depths of the Depression, when the unemployed were being forced into work for the Dole projects. And it goes like this. It's a portrayal of the ruling class attitudes. "Now work for the Dole, you bastards. Take that gleam of hope from your eye. Just work for the Dole, you bastards, or watch your children die. We've got batons and bullets, you bastards. We'll see you all toe the line. But we'd keep you all down much better if it weren't for these communist swine." Not great literature, but for me inspiring, because we have here, we can clearly see here a fighting movement fighting its way up. Okay, move forward 20, 30 years to post-war Poland, a poem by a dissident who's experienced the Communist Party in government and didn't enjoy it very much. And this is he makes a reference to the utopian socialist Charles Fourier. The poem goes, "The old dreamer Fourier said the sea would run with lemonade. And is it not so? They drink seawater, crying, 'Lemonade, lemonade,' and they run home to vomit in private." So, two very different sides of the communist story. On the one hand, the inspirational, and on the other hand, the tragic. And they're both, one way or another, background to this book that I wrote, which was initially, the research was done in the 1970s, published in the 1980s, reprinted just last year, 2009. And I guess when you wait that long to reprint a book, and it's essentially verbatim, two questions arise. One is, why did you write the book in the first place? And that's a complicated question, so I'll come back to that. But the second is, there's no Communist Party anymore. Why are you bothering? Why should we read this stuff in 2010? But the answer there, I think, is fairly simple, and it is that we need to learn from the communist experience, both the inspirational and the tragic, if we're going to go forward to trying to build a new revolutionary Communist Party, Socialist Party, Marxist Party in Australia. And so I'm going to try to pursue this sort of yet plus and minus dichotomy for a little bit and talk about a couple of different subjects within that. First of all, an ideology. The communists were internationalists. That is, your average communist was deeply imbued with the idea of international solidarity. They cared passionately about the fate of the colonized peoples of Asia. They cared passionately about the fate of the Spanish Republic. Yes, and they cared passionately about defending the rights of Aboriginal people in Australia, and yet at the same time, they could degenerate, the Communist Party could degenerate into the most vulgar kind of nationalism and racism. And I'll give you an example, unfortunately, later on. They were an organization that believed in working class struggle, the rank and file, mobilizing workers, and yet at the same time, they were capable of descending into the most ridiculous pursuit of bureaucratic positions, even rigging ballots in order to secure trade union official positions and adopting the manipulative mentality of the trade union bureaucracy. Put in general terms, the communists had a sense of wanting to liberate humanity from oppression and exploitation, and yet at the same time, they embraced, after all, a bureaucratic, exploitative, oppressive dictatorship in the Soviet Union and later in Eastern Europe. So this deeply ambiguous two-sided picture appears. And the same two-sidedness appears if we look at the practical interventions they made on the ground, or in some cases didn't make on the ground. Now, for my book, the most fantastic thing the Communist Party ever did in its whole history was to rebuild militant trade unionism in the depths of the Depression. I'm talking about a labor movement that had been hit by savage defeats, industrial defeats in the late 1920s, and then was swamped with gigantic unemployment. Unemployment in Australia went up to something like 28%. You can imagine the impact this has on trying to maintain union organization. In this era, the Communist Party set out to rebuild the militant labor movement. And they did it through a rank-and-file organization called the Militant Minority Movement, in which there were about 50% communists and 50% others, and they worked alongside other militants, independent of the trade union officials, to rebuild the movement. And they won a historic strike in Wonthaggi in the Victorian coalfields. They won strikes in the northern cane fields of Queensland. They won a series of battles that put Australian militant trade unionism back on the map. And broadly associated with this, a determined militant approach to fighting for women's rights and women's liberation. There is a myth around that the Communist Party didn't care about women. This is rubbish. What they did have was a very, very class-oriented, working-class-oriented, class-struggle-oriented approach to women's liberation. They put out a paper called The Working Woman. It said, "We're not going to publish any household hints. We're not going to publish any recipes. This is about the struggle." And it was epitomized, I think, very nicely in a quote from The Working Woman, which described a woman picket jumping on the back of a scab and bearing him to the ground, kicking and screaming. That was the spirit of the Communist Party in the early 30s. A bit later on, the campaigns against war and fascism, also tremendously important. The communists were the ones who warned about these dangers first and longest and hardest. They put on a play in Sydney that was so offensive to the German consulate that the German consulate got it shut down by ringing the Australian government. They brought in international speakers to warn about these dangers, speakers from Europe. I understand our Palestinian speaker was grilled by Australian immigration authorities when he entered Australia. At least he got in. Egon Kish came from Europe. They didn't want him in. They used a language dictation test from the White Australia policy to try to get to keep him out. But every European language they gave him, he could read. So finally they used Scottish Gaelic to keep him out. So then he jumped from the boat onto the wharf and broke his leg in order to get into Australia to warn against these dangers. Such a fantastic tradition, and yet, on the other hand, broadly in the same period when the communists were fighting alongside other militants in the minority movement, they passed up historic opportunities in the New South Wales Labour Party, where there were these things called socialization units that were socialist branches of the Labour Party, campaigning for socialism, knocking on doors in working class suburbs, campaigning for socialism. The Communist Party turned its back on it, condemned it, in fact. A year or so later, the Labour Premier of New South Wales, Jack Lang, was sacked by the governor of the state because he defied the banks. Workers came out into the streets, 250,000 workers in the streets of Sydney. The Communist Party turns its back on it. Now, how could this happen? Well, they had some extremely stupid advice from the Soviet leadership in Russia. It went like this. The main danger is fascism. The conservative parties are laying the basis for fascism. So is the Labour Party, because, you see, the Labour Party believes in capitalism, and therefore that leads us to fascism, and therefore the Labour Party is also fascist. They called it social fascist. And the left wing of the Labour Party is even worse, because people have illusions in them. So they're left social fascists. And so on this basis, we turn our back on the actual struggles of the time. Now, that was a sectarian policy. It did fade. As we moved toward the middle 30s, and it was replaced by something else that sounded a lot better, but in fact was not really much better at all, and that was the so-called People's Front policy. The idea here was, again, fascism is the immediate threat. Socialism, well, we're for socialism, but we can't worry about that right now because we've got this immediate threat. So socialism will postpone to the indefinite future, and instead of that, we'll fight for democracy and we'll build an alliance for democracy. Everybody who's for democracy can be in this alliance, including sections of the capitalist class, because some capitalists are quite happy with parliamentary democracy. So we include them in the alliance. That's how we get this broad people's front. Now, this sounds persuasive for about 30 seconds until you think about it. I mean, not only does it put the struggle for socialism off into the never-never land somewhere, but it, more importantly, in a way, it means you hold back the immediate struggles that you're involved in. Because how can you have fighting mass strikes and occupations when you're in an alliance with a section of the capitalists? They don't like strikes and occupations. How can you have militant mass demonstrations when the capitalists don't like militant mass demonstrations? It becomes a thing where you hold back the struggle and you water down your politics in order to accommodate these enemies of your own class. And this is what happened to the working woman. It gave way to another publication with the bland, neutral name Woman Today. And it did have recipes and it did have household hints. It had ads for waxing. We're talking about a watering down of the politics of your sacrificing of your principles in order to accommodate these essentially capitalist elements. Something else that happened that was broadly associated with this, because it's all about a move to the right ultimately, is that the Communist Party began to move into official trade union positions. Now, they had huge credibility because of their role in rebuilding militant trade unionism, and they were able to use this to win union positions. The problem is they began to orient to those union positions and to people who were already in them, the Labour Party trade union officials as well. And this is the point at which the Communist Party starts to become more the party of trade union leaders and less the party of the militant rank-and-file workers. So that's the kind of brief summary of the 30s. It has its pluses and its minuses. I think on balance we have to draw a positive balance sheet out of the experience because, if nothing else, they built a sizable organization. They started with about 250, 300 people at the end of the 20s. By the end of the 30s, they had something like 5,000. And this is really important for us because it shows you that if things break your way, and that's important, they have to break your way, but if and when they do, if you have the right organization, you can build an organization up from hundreds to thousands. And I think it's very encouraging, you know, to remember that. And I think the communists running up to World War II must have felt pretty confident. They must have felt they sort of had their act together pretty definitely. And World War II is, in some ways, a high point, undoubtedly, of Australian communism, but it has the same ambiguities. Let's talk about the positives first. The communists had a membership of 3,000 to 4,000 of their members inside the military. And they had a strong organization inside the military. Unlike the CPs of Britain or the United States, which thought that was disrupting the war effort, the Australian communists maintained their organization inside the military. Let's discuss what this meant. A series of Communist Party branches in Port Moresby and around Papua, a series of Marxist economic study groups in Port Moresby and Papua, and on the Australian continent, North Queensland, where they brought together large numbers of people for training, military training. The communists called a conference of their in the military organization, delegates representing the rank and file, which attracted 50 delegates. So a significant organization, and they used it to defend the rights of the rank-and-file soldiers. Conditions, food, but also political rights and so on, stood up for the soldiers and were prepared to do things like call strikes inside the military, in other words, mutiny, to defend the workers. Ted Bacon, an old communist who I met in the 1970s, was involved in this, and he was interviewed about it before he died. And he said this, he said, "Successful strikes without victimization of leaders were far more common than might be imagined by those who believe a military bureaucracy is unbeatable. Refusals to parade until food or conditions were improved occurred in almost all training camps." Fantastic accomplishment. And yet, on the other hand, what is the politics of this situation? The Communist Party embraces the war effort because the Soviet Union is in the war, and the Soviet Union, the crucial thing is to win that war. Embraces the war effort, embraces, therefore, the ideology, the nationalism of the Australian state. Not just the nationalism of the Australian state, but where do we know Australian nationalism takes us? The racism of the Australian state. And so that, for example, they published a cartoon that shows a Japanese person on their back with bombs raining down on them, and the caption for the cartoon is, "Jappy ending." They published a pamphlet called Smash Japan, in which there's a description of a Japanese officer. I'll read you a bit of it. "An officer with a physique in tune with his dwarf, twisted soul, ridiculously small, bow-legged, repulsive to look at." It goes on. Racism. So a highly contradictory political party within a contradictory global movement. And it was to try to unravel these contradictions and grasp the dynamic, I came up with a couple of very simple visual metaphors. The first is a vicious cycle, or vicious circle, I used to say in the United States. And the other is an unstable triangle. The vicious cycle is about getting back to the origins of communism in the Russian Revolution. Russian Revolution led by people like Lenin and Trotsky, who understood that you cannot build socialism in a single country, a single impoverished country like they were in. You have to spread the revolution to the West. And to this end, they fostered young communist parties in Western Europe and around the world who were in the Communist International. And the idea was they would lead these revolutions that would take the thing to the next stage. But the revolutions were defeated. And when they were defeated, this led to a huge blow to the confidence of these young communist parties, who began to rely more and more on the Soviet leadership for advice and instruction. The trouble was, precisely because they were isolated, the Soviet leadership were beginning to degenerate in the direction of what became Stalinism, and the advice and instruction wasn't always so good. And this led to further defeats, further lack of confidence, further dependence on the Soviet Union, a vicious cycle, the outcome of which is Stalinist dictatorship in Russia, and communist parties, which are subordinated to the politics and become advocates for the foreign policy in particular, the needs of the Soviet Union. So this then creates a situation which I describe as triangular. What I mean here is this. If you think of a typical workers' party, whether it be the Labour Party or whether it be the kind of workers' party we want to build, the Revolutionary Workers' Party, either way, you're in a relatively simple class location. You're based on the working class, and you claim, rightly or wrongly, to represent its needs. And if you look up, there's the ruling class and its state and its parliament. And if you're the Labour Party, you want to administer the state and collaborate with the ruling class. And if you're us, you want to smash the state and smash the ruling class. But either way, the location is simple. The Communist Party is more complicated. There is a third player in the picture, which is the Soviet bureaucracy, which is calling so many of the shots among the Communist parties. And what does that mean? It means that the viability, the credibility, the morale, all kind of things of the Communist parties in the West, a place like Australia, depends upon the prestige and the credibility of the Soviet Union and later its satellites. And that's fine in the 1930s when the Soviet economy is growing like crazy at a time when the Western economies are mired in depression. It works, continues to work in the 40s when the Soviet Red Army plays such a big role in smashing the armies of Hitler. Tremendous prestige arising out of that. But from the 1950s onwards, you start to get a situation where the increasing crises and contradictions of the Stalinist system begin to become a problem for the communist parties in the West. And then they begin to ask themselves, do we really need this communist Russian connection? You know, is it nothing but an albatross around our necks, and should we break with the Soviet Union? And some of the biggest parties in this early post-war period begin to do it, particularly the Italian Communist Party begins to move away from that Soviet connection. But this is all leads to contradictory outcomes, which I'll talk about in a moment. But first, we're going to see some pictures that will illustrate what I've been talking about and a little bit of what's to come. Okay. The Soviet Union is isolated, as I mentioned. Actually, it was invaded by imperialist armies, but there was also a reactionary quiet army within the Soviet Union. And this is an indication of why it was so impossible to try to build socialism in a single impoverished country. Communists organizing women workers. In case anybody ever tells you the communists didn't care about women workers or about women, just remember this one. Strikes by women fomented by communists. Egon Kescher jumped off the boat. Now, this is Lance Sharkey. I didn't mention him, but he was the secretary of the Communist Party for a very long time. And you're a bit of a villain. No doubt he was a villain. But something like 10,000 waterside workers followed his coffin when he died. So he's a significant figure. And it tells you something about the presence of communism in the old days. Cartoons from the coal strike. Stavrum used the Army, Navy, and Air Force. They did use the Army, in fact. They used the military against the coal strike. Now we're moving into what I'll be talking about, the move to ban the Communist Party by the Liberal Prime Minister Bob Menzies. This is the law in 1950. I think the actual referendum is 1951.
That's the Act.
The Act is 1950. But I think that was then disallowed in the Senate, and they had to go to a referendum. Catherine Susanna Pritchard, a well-known writer. May Day. CPA, Communist Party of Australia. You know about the Hungarian uprising, I'll be talking about that. May Day 1961. I'll be mentioning him. From 1968. And I think this is the last one. Testimony to the radicalism the Communist Party was capable of in its best moments. You notice this? That one's another talk. It's a good slide, though. Okay, so I've talked about the 30s and the World War II period, which really is the rise of Australian communism, and it's now time to talk about the decline and fall. And I think the date probably to start with is the defeat of the 1949 coal strike, which you saw a cartoon about. The communists were defeated in this coal strike, which they launched as an attempt to win leadership of the Australian labor movement away from the Labor Party. And they did this at a time when not only did they not have the troops to accomplish it, but they did it at a time when social conditions, the social climate was getting worse and worse and made it more and more difficult for communism, for the communists to prevail. What was breaking out was the Cold War, and this has an international background. You have the international polarization between the Soviet Union and its satellites on the one hand and Western capitalism on the other, sharp polarization leading to a highly repressive atmosphere inside Australia and therefore for the communists. You had, I think we showed you the attempt to ban the Communist Party in 1950-51, which was not successful, but it was a close call. There was also the Petrov affair, a spy scandal, which was used to try to create the feeling that communists were evil, sinister people that were out to destroy everything decent in society. And this kind of climate had a significant impact on the Communist Party membership. It had been about 12,000 still in 1947. It was down to about 8,000 by the middle of the 1950s. But it's amazing how many communists, particularly working-class communists, said to themselves, we have to stick by this party. This is our party. We built this party. Don't abandon it. You know, things will get better eventually. Unfortunately, in 1956, they got a lot worse. And this is what Khrushchev's about. Khrushchev succeeded Stalin. Stalin died in, 1952? By 1956, Khrushchev is established as his successor and made a secret speech in which he denounced the crimes of Stalin. The Gulag, the lot, laid it all out, and the secret speech was quickly leaked to the New York Times, which was probably intentional, and it was out there in the public arena, a huge psychological blow to communists. Now, the CPs could, and some did, pretend that it was a forgery. The Australian Communist Party said it's a fake. But it's clear from the memoirs that the dedicated communist members, once they read this speech, they knew it was true. Tremendous blow. But only the start of things, because the speech created an atmosphere in Eastern Europe which fomented rebellion, which particularly focused in Hungary. The Hungarian uprising of 1956, workers in the streets, workers forming workers' councils, who showed you a picture. And Nikita Khrushchev, who probably thought he was going to go down in history as Mr. Nice Guy because he criticized Stalin, goes down in history as the man who sent the tanks into Budapest in 1956 to crush the aspirations of the Hungarian workers. And this led to a further loss of members, particularly intellectuals left in 1956. But it's remarkable still how many people said, stick with the party. You know, the organization, we've taken all these blows and we've lost members, but the organization is still together. We're still intact. Unfortunately, in 1960-61, there was a split. And the background of this is also international. It is the polarization, the split between the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China. Mao Zedong is now in charge of China. He doesn't like taking orders from the Russians. He's noticed how Stalin used the Communist Party as diplomatic levers, and he tries to do the same. He appeals to the international communist movement to back him against the Russians. And he does this partly with utterly ferocious revolutionary rhetoric. But what's really more significant, I think, is that what he does is he plays on what I call Stalinist dissent. Now, we usually think, when we talk about communist parties, we think of dissidents as being liberals of some kind. But there were also Stalinist dissenters, people who didn't like the fact that Khrushchev criticized Stalin. You know, after all, their party had grown up under Stalin. Some individual leaders had effectively been appointed by Stalin's, you know, close associates in the Kremlin. They didn't like this. And so there was a significant minority of the Australian party, including the Victorian State Secretary, some significant trade union officials, Norm Gallagher, Clary O'Shea, who marched out to form something called the Communist Party of Australia, Marxist-Leninist. Now, that group's actually still with us today, although it's very small, but you might come across them. But I'm not going to pursue that, because I'm going to stick with the history of the main Communist Party. So another blow to morale, another loss of membership. But it's amazing how many communists still sticking in there. This is our party. We fought for it. We're not going to abandon it. And because sooner or later there will be a radicalization. And when that happens, people will come to us. Well, there was a radicalization after 1968, but there wasn't much benefit in it for the Communist Party. This is partly because they were old and tired. They were very dogmatic after all the years of battling through the repression. But equally important was the fact that they had this connection with the Soviet Union, which had sent the tanks into Hungary, and by this time had done a series of other things as well that outraged people. So this was a problem for the communists. And it got worse in 1968 because something like that happened again. And this was the liberal reform movement in Czechoslovakia, known as the Prague Spring. The Australian communists put a tremendous amount of their hopes into this Prague Spring, hoping that it would create what was called socialism with a human face. But as you know, at the end of the day, the Soviet Union sends the tanks in again to crush the aspirations of the workers, the people of Czechoslovakia. And this is the point at which the Communist Party of Australia decides it's fed up with the Russian connection. It is time to break with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is just a huge obstacle to the communists getting anywhere. You know, everywhere you go, you have your nose rubbed in it. They want to break with the Soviet Union. And they denounced the invasion of Czechoslovakia. In the state, the National Secretary, Laurie Ahrens, made a speech to a big meeting in the Sydney Town Hall condemning what the Soviet Union had done. And from this point on, the communists were on what they considered to be an independent course. But again, not without a split, because the Stalinist dissent thing was still operating. There were party leaders and there were senior trade union officials who, defending the Soviet Union had been a mainstay for their entire political lives. They would not abandon the Soviet Union, and they marched out to form something called the Socialist Party of Australia. Now, that's also still with us. Later on, when the Communist Party was gone, they took the name Communist Party of Australia. If you encounter somebody with that name, it's this group of pro-Soviet people that left in around 1970, not the Communist Party that I'm talking about. So we have a new independent course, but what is the politics of an independent course? It can mean any number of things, and for most of the Communist parties, it meant looking for some kind of social democratic type position in the social mainstream. Now, the Australian Communist Party also wanted to be in the social mainstream, as it turned out. But what they did in the short run took us all by surprise. They made a sharp turn to the left. Now, this was disconcerting. We had a theory we thought explained the role of the Communist parties. And their role was to sell out and move to the right. They were not supposed to go to the left. So, but it was more than that. It was a practical problem because people were joining them who should have been joining us because they presented themselves as revolutionaries and they were a lot bigger than we were. So this is, if you want to know why I wrote the book, this is the starting point for it. I tried to research the background of all this stuff to try to figure out what is the dynamic of this left turn. Let me first give you a feeling for the dimensions of the left turn, which were superficially at least quite impressive. First of all, an important role played by communist union officials in the mass strikes of 1969, which freed the trade union official Clary O'Shea and made a dead letter out of the anti-union legislation, the penal powers, similar to work choices, which Bob Menzies, the conservatives, had imposed in the 1950s. Laurie Ahrens, the Communist Party national secretary, declared that it was time to break with the arbitration system because arbitration, he said, stinks in the nostrils of the masses. Revolutionary rhetoric, at least. Other things, the New South Wales Builders Labourers and Jack Mundy. Now, Jack Mundy was a Communist Party official in the Builders Labourers Federation in New South Wales. There were other leaders who were not in the Communist Party, but still it tended to be associated with the CPA. And you've probably heard of the green bands, the environmental bands. I don't so much have that in mind because actually other branches of the union, including Mundy's enemies, also implemented green bands. There's buildings all over Melbourne that were saved by union green bands. But Mundy was also associated with an atmosphere of workers' control, where if you didn't like the foreman, you sacked them and elect a new one. He and his members were prepared to fight for the rights of women to work in the building industry. They supported the rights of a gay student at Macquarie University. Very impressive stuff. Trotskyism. A flirtation with Trotskyism. I couldn't believe this the first time I came across it. The Communist Party's traditionally would say that Trotskyists were fascist agents. Now we have the Communist Party of Australia not only using Trotskyist vocabulary, but individual Trotskyists in Sydney actually joined the party, and one of them ended up in the leadership. Now, you know, this is amazing. CPA women in Sydney, not particularly in Melbourne, were significant in the formation of the early women's liberation movement. So quite a radical sort of face that's being presented by the Communist Party after 1968 and into the 1970s. So we had to analyze this. And I went to work. Once you scratch the surface, you discovered it wasn't quite what it appeared. First of all, it was eclectic. In other words, they took ideas from anywhere, as long as they were radical, and put them all together. And this was summed up for me by a Communist Party election poster in 1974, which had pictures of the following: Marx, Lenin, Trotsky, Mao, Ho Chi Minh, the leader of the Vietnamese state, Fidel Castro, Alexander Dubček, the leader of the Prague Reform Movement. Now, what a mix. You know, you wanted to go up to the Communist Party comrades. You wanted to go up and say, comrade, don't you know that Ho Chi Minh was in favor of killing Trotskyists? Don't you know that Fidel Castro supported the invasion of Czechoslovakia? And so on. You know, these contradictory things. You know, that showed you how superficial it was. The New South Wales Builders Labourers, when they came under attack from their national office and they were deregistered and they were smashed up, with one exception, the Communist Party trade union officials did nothing to protect them. They hung Jack Mundy out to dry. They really didn't have any enthusiasm for this radical workers' control stuff when you put them to the test. to Trotskyism turned out to be not the ideas of Leon Trotsky, who was a fire-breathing revolutionary who wanted to overthrow the Stalinist state. They were the ideas of Isaac Deutscher, mm-hmm. whose version of Trotskyism was basically, well, Stalinism was really bad, but it was kind of inevitable, and things will change eventually. That's probably a bit unfair, but, you know, time is short. So it wasn't, you know, it was the sort of thing that, people who'd gone through Stalinism could live with, you know, and it didn't go any further. The feminism, well, what happened in practice is that at a certain point it emerged that the feminists and the Communist Party saw their ideas as incompatible with Marxism. They saw Marxism as having nothing to offer or even perhaps an obstacle. And so there, too, it wasn't the Marxist radicalism that one might have expected. So what I think happened, and I'm fairly confident now, looking back on it, this analysis was right, and it's the one I made at the time, that the Communist Party had broken with the Soviet Union, broken with Stalinism, and they wanted to find a place in the mainstream of society. But this is just at a point when society is moving dramatically to the left. Mm-hmm. Social radicalization, mass student movement, mass anti-war movement, huge strike waves, gay liberation emerging, Aboriginal land rights, I'd probably extend the list indefinitely, all these things going on. The Communist Party followed the crowd. The crowd is moving to the left, the Communist Party followed the crowd. Later on, from 1975 onwards, when Australian society moved back to the right, the Communist Party follows the crowd again, and ends up, in fact, in what is, if you like, the long-term mainstream political zone of Australia. And we can illustrate this with three examples. First of all, the role of an intellectual called Eric Ahrens, the most important intellectual figure in all this, who set out to study liberal ideas in philosophy and Western thought generally and take those liberal ideas and bring them back into the party and integrate them into whatever was left of the semi-Marxism of the Communist Party of Australia. There was the ALP-ACTU Accord. This is Bob Hawke when he became Prime Minister in 1983, implemented a bureaucratic sort of agreement, a social contract agreement, whereby the Australian working class sacrificed its right to strike in exchange for a planning process that ripped them off. And a lot of the formulation work went of this, and a lot of the background to it comes from the Communist Party of Australia. And the third thing was what happened inside the party itself, a centrifugal tendency inside the party. There were all these groups inside the party who had no particular interest in each other, no particular commitment to each other. The women's collective, the newspaper collective, the bookshop, trade union branches, the various other groups, you know, social groups, movement groups, who were in the party because there were resources there. But eventually this whole thing was pulled apart by the centrifugal nature of the situation. And the Communist Party entered its final decline, and by 1985, 1990, it was history. And it left us with a question and some lessons. The question is, that we would have asked ourselves at the time, and we still need to ask ourselves, are we glad about this? Isn't it a matter of good riddance to this boring, bureaucratic old Stalinist party that was a bloody obstacle? Or is it regret that another piece of the left is gone, the process of decline continues? And the answer is that really it's both. On the one hand, the Communist Party of Australia had to go. You cannot build a struggle for socialism based on the politics of a bureaucratic dictatorship of the Soviet Union. But on the other hand, we were always clear, we were not in any hurry to see the demise of the Communist Party until we could replace it, until we could fill its shoes. And we couldn't fill its shoes, and we still haven't been able to fill its shoes. And that's a huge problem. And it was really brought home to me by an old ex-communist named Vic Williams, who worked at the Union Carbide plant in Altona. There was a famous strike there. And later on, I interviewed him because he was an ex-communist. I interviewed him. And he said to me, you know, that strike brought home to me something. There used to be a Communist Party. When we wanted something to be organized on the wharves or in the railways or in Footscray or Essendon or whatever it was, there was somebody to ring. There was a network. It's not there anymore. And he was right. And it's a huge problem. And we need to build something to replace it. And that is why when we appeal to you, if you're not members of Socialist Alternative, to consider getting involved with us in building that alternative, it's based on this crying need to fill that space. In terms of the lessons, well, probably a heap of lessons emerge out of what I've said. I hope so. I'm not going to try to retrieve them all, but I'll touch on three before I conclude. The first is that you need a global perspective based on the needs of the international working class rather than one based on national divisions and national demarcations. This is tremendously important. When the communists did this, they were usually pretty good. When they forgot about it, you ended up with a Jaffe ending. Very important. Secondly, You need to be able to work alongside worker militants, other fighters. Even if they don't have your politics, they have illusions in the Labour Party, doesn't matter. You have to be prepared to work alongside other people in a united manner. But at the same time, you don't water down your politics. You don't sacrifice your independent position. Certainly not to provide some sort of entry for elements who are our enemies, like sections of the capitalist class. And thirdly, we have to be clear on what socialism is. Socialism is not about planning from the top down. It is not about bureaucracies. It is not about tyranny of a state like the Soviet Union. It is about the self-emancipation of the working class and oppressed people, or it's nothing. And it's by remembering that that we can begin to separate out in the communist history the inspirational from the tragic. Thank you.